Good evening and welcome to The Final Draft, where we talk all things books and writing for 2SER. I'm Netta Vanavak, and tonight I have for you a chat with Louis Nara about his new book, Into That Forest. It's the story of two girls raised by Tasmanian tigers in the 1880s. And we also have a reading for you from Voiceworks magazine by Lisa Parry. It's a tale of reimagining the once-loved places of childhood. But before we get into that, let's talk Hilary Mantel. In all the kerfuffle around Supporter Drive last week, I didn't even get to talk about her very exciting news. And as everybody knows by now, Hilary Mantel took out her second Booker Prize for Bring Up the Bodies, which is a sequel to 2009's Wolf Hall. Not only is she the first British novelist and the first woman to win the prize twice, she's also the first writer to win twice with a sequel. Now, if you're not familiar with the series, and I'm working through it at the moment myself, Bring Up the Bodies is the second in a Tudor trilogy following Thomas Cromwell, his minister to Henry VIII. Henry is falling in love with Jane Seymour and looking for a way to do away with Anne Boleyn, his current queen. Anne and Thomas are pitted against one another as he searches for a legitimate way to expel her from the court. And here is Hilary talking about Bring Up the Bodies, courtesy of the Fourth Estate, UK.
Anne, like Thomas Cromwell, is an ambiguous character. You can take all sorts of lines, you can pick all sorts of lines as you go through her story. Some readers will think my view of Anne is harsh, but it isn't really my view. I'm looking at her as I think Thomas Cromwell might have looked at her. She is a worthy opponent. He believes he must destroy Anne before she destroys him. The way Anne's story ended up, no one could have dreamt or predicted. She had always been a flirt. She was a highly attractive woman whose sexuality had seen her through her life and taken her to the position of Queen of England. But you might think that by the time she and Henry got into bed together, the effort had exhausted them both, and there are signs of things going wrong from the early days. They were together in the end only for 3 years, and during that time, they quarrel, they make up, they quarrel, they make up. Henry is looking to Anne to give him the son that he says she has promised him, the son to succeed him, to secure England, make England safe from civil war. Anne has three pregnancies that we know about. The first results in a daughter. They don't know at the time that this will be Queen Elizabeth, one of the greatest monarchs in English history. They just think, oh, a girl, what use is a girl to us? There are two more pregnancies. There are two miscarriages. Anne has broken her promise, according to Henry. And he's bored and he's beginning to look at other women. And she won't accept that as the former queen did. She's jealous. She's angry. And also, her confidence is waning. And she seeks to restore her confidence by relationships with other men. We don't know how far those relationships were. Henry said at one point before her death that he thought she'd committed adultery with 100 men. Obviously, she may not have committed adultery with anyone at all, but 5 men were accused with her. 5 men died because of it. One of them was her own brother, who was accused of illicit relations with her. It's impossible to be sure at this point whether Anne was guilty at all, but the point was that she, at certain points, gave the impression of a woman who was guilty, even if not guilty as charged. So she remains unexplained. I think this is crucial. I cannot give the reader a definitive version. What I can do is I can track the process hour by hour, trying to follow the people as They move on their complex dance around each other, trying to see it through their eyes. And emphasizing, as I've said, they're living through it. They don't know the end of their story as we do. At the time, there seemed nothing inevitable about it. I try to preserve the mystery. I try also to preserve the tragedy, because whether Anne was guilty or not guilty, this was a tragedy on a huge scale.
Playwright, librettist, essayist, screenwriter, novelist, memoirist, Louis Nara has tried his hand at writing almost everything. His new novel, Into That Forest, is ostensibly written for young adults because Louis says he needed readers who could suspend their disbelief. And why? Well, Hannah and Rebecca are two young girls in the 1880s caught in a terrible storm who end up orphaned, lost, and taken in by two Tasmanian tigers. Their years in the forest will mark their lives forever, and the story is about the brutality and kindness of people and animals, losing your language, and the extinction of a species. I spoke to Louis while he was out walking his dogs, and he explained just how similar the Tasmanian tiger is to a chihuahua.
Chihuahuas, like every dog, is 99.94% wolf. So, look, chihuahuas are exactly the same as Alsatians in the sense of their basic behaviour. They have different aims and objectives for what dogs do. Like Basil is a miniature pincer, and they're ratters. So his behaviour is very, very different. The thing is, when you look at dogs really, really closely, you understand that they watch you more closely than we watch them, is because they're dependent upon us for their lives.
So they're kind of trying to gauge what we're going to do before we do it.
Yeah, they look at our body language, our smells, and they hear our voice, what pitch it is, and they work out whether that person's angry. And so that was a great help to think, rather than be anthropomorphic about dogs, is try and make Tasmanian tigers' behaviour as canine as possible.
Were you ever tempted to go down that route of anthropomorphising them, given that it's narrated by a child and that she might see them in that way?
That's a very good point. One of the things about Hannah, who narrates it, is that she was a farm girl and she liked animals, but she realised that they were animals. So although she kind of gives characteristics to the two Tasmanian tigers, she does know that they're animals. They're not cartoon characters.
Yeah, but she does take them on as a mother and father figure too.
Yes, because she's lost her mother and father.
Mm.
And unlike Rebecca, who hasn't lost her father, I think she needs the tigers more than probably her older friend Rebecca needs them.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because it certainly seems that way at the beginning, but then towards the end it seems that Rebecca realises that she's made a huge mistake and that she might have been better off there all along.
Yes, look, I think that's a very good point, but I also think it is that the tigers represent for Rebecca that time she spent in the wilderness with Hannah, and so the tigers almost represent the life she had with Hannah and how much she really liked Hannah before the two girls were pulled apart. So the tigers represent more than just being tigers.
Obviously, as a playwright, you're acutely aware of language, and the way that she narrates is so very specific, you know, the kind of language that you've chosen to use there.
When I started the novel, I was a bit unsure about the voice, and I read a section of Into That Forest, and I realised that I could hear the narrator's voice, Hannah's voice. So it was a great thing for me to be able to read that out aloud and hear the rhythms of how Hannah speaks. And so I realised that it wasn't written. Hannah wasn't writing this. She was speaking to somebody. I thought one of the things that would happen if you're very young, say 5 or 6, and you're brought up by a wolf or a Tasmanian tiger, you'd lose a sense of language, which does happen. When you look at studies like the Wild Boy Avion in France, one of the things that comes across, if you are taken too early and brought up by a wolf or a dog too early, and you haven't learned to speak, you'll never learn to speak again. So Hannah had to have a little grasp of language before she lived with the Tasmanian Tigers.
I wouldn't mind taking a step back, actually, and asking how it was that you and Vincent Ward first decided to write about Hannah and Rebecca.
Vincent phoned me. He said, look, I'm only in Australia for a few days. Let's get together and tell stories to one another. An idea of coming up with a film. Then I was very interested in a book by Charles McLean called The Wolf Children about two kids in the 1920s in India who were brought up by wolves.
Amala and Kamala, wasn't it?
Yeah. And we started to talk about that, what would actually happen with Tasmanian tigers, and we went on a few recces down in Tasmania and we got a story and then it sort of all fell apart.
Fell apart in what way?
Nobody was really interested. You can understand the Australian cinema, if anything's a bit strange or requires a leap of faith in its storytelling. Australians are very realistic. They're very naturalistic. So anything that was sort of moved towards this mysterious leap of faith, two girls being brought up with Tasmanian tigers, not many people were interested.
Is that why you ended up pitching it towards a young adult market?
Almost. What actually happened is I started to write it and realised that maybe adults are a bit more jaundiced through experience, that in fact the young adult market is, their imaginations are not so jaundiced, that I think younger people would take that leap of faith that that is possible, two girls being brought up by Tasmanian tigers. And I realised that was the audience. And, you know, if it meant that some adults like the book, that would be great. But I realised I needed readers to make that leap of faith.
I find it really interesting that you say that it's kids that can make that leap of faith, given that there are so many examples over the centuries of these children raised by not only Tasmanian tigers and wolves and monkeys. There was a story about a gazelle boy in Syria.
I mean, yeah, that was a fake.
Yeah, that's a fake. And apparently so were the two girls in India.
Well, I'm a bit dubious about that. I still think there was something that actually happened that wasn't. I know nowadays there is a thing that they could be fakes, but I don't know. It seems so elaborate, the fraud. But I would imagine it was a mixture of kind of fiction and non-fiction.
What's the fascination of this idea that young people can be raised into a totally animalistic way? I mean, is like in the news stories, it seems so much to be an issue of neglect or suffering, but in Into That Forest, it really seems like a wild kind of freedom.
Well, it is romantic, Into That Forest. But one of the things that really attracts people to those stories and horrifies them is, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be brought up by animals? Are you animal or human? From the very time of the founding of Rome, Romulus and Remus being kept alive by a wolf, and the founding of Rome, it's that thing about, you know, how much are you an animal? When you lose your language and you regain it again, how do you view the world? If you're brought up with animals, do you view the world through the eyes of a chimpanzee or wolf or whatever? It's, to me, very, very interesting.
And the answer is a little murky.
Yeah. Well, it's fiction.
The descriptions of hunting in the book are so visceral, and there's a sequence where the two girls and the tigers are killing seals on a beach. And yeah. I think you've talked previously about your own experience killing seals in the Arctic. Yeah. Is that something you're drawing upon, that bloodlust and that the richness of eating raw meat like that?
The good thing is I know what a seal tastes like.
What and does a seal taste like?
Well, you see, you've got the black outer skin, which is really tough. It's like a tyre, like a car tyre. And inside is the gristle, the pink gristle, or the blubber, and you chew it. It's like it hits your adrenaline glands, and it goes right up the side of your nostril, and it hits where the third eye is, and you're really sparky. It really gives you this incredible adrenaline hit. And so it was good to know that, you know, what they ate. But the other thing that I learned when I was with the Eskimos, which they do like to be called rather than Inuit, was that they say that the animal sacrifices itself for them. And what I wanted was for the young readers to go, look, if you're hungry and you have to kill, you have to kill, earn that corpse. You have to earn that meal.
I wanted to ask you about the research that you did into the thylacine and this, what, the mythological appeal of the Tasmanian tiger.
One of the things why there's so many books coming out Tasmanian tigers is this huge regret Australians have that it was only in the 1930s that the Tasmanian tigers died out. And there is this sense of, you know, in terms of history, that's very recent. An animal is different and is insular, as this one in Tasmania died out. And it's sort of, I think we feel guilty, you know, that they did die out and that we were responsible for it and we didn't have to do that. The Tasmanian tigers didn't kill the sheep that the farmers said they did. And really, the other thing that appalls people when you read about it is just we were so indifferent in the 1930s. We didn't care. We had the last Tasmanian tigers in the Beaumaris Zoo down in Hobart, and we got 30 seconds of film.
Yeah, and that's it. There's that 30 seconds. And
it's so frustrating.
That was Louis Nara talking about his new book, Into That Forest.
2SER. Independent and community focused.
Switch on 2SER.
2SER. Real radio.
2SER.
107.3.
2SER.
Volunteer powered and listener supported.
107.3 FM.
And now digital.
Switch on.
You're listening to The Final Draft, and tonight we have a reading for you to usher in summer, which is already so very tantalisingly close. Elisa Parry is a New South Wales-based writer, and her story, Illustrations, is featured in the space edition of Voiceworks magazine. Every year when she was young, Elisa would go camping around Easter to the same spot with the same group of family and friends, but she hasn't been back for almost 10 years. The story came from imagining what some of those places would be like now in the hope that if she did return one day, nothing will have changed.
His skin's like elastic. The lines beside his mouth reach up to the corners of his eyes, folding into themselves when he smiles, like origami. She remembers when he pulled it out from his neck, a thin sheet of pink just to prove how far it could stretch. The only party trick she knows is how to roll her tongue, but he wasn't impressed. Apparently loads of people can do that. He played at the pub on Friday night. She liked the way his face stretched around the words, the smile in his voice. Afterwards, he came over and introduced himself. No bullshit. A strong handshake and a dry palm. His name was Max. Was she just passing through? She thought about lying, but she was always cautious. No, not really. She'd scored 2 weeks off work and planned to stick around for most of it. Something she'd been meaning to do for a while. The wine was good and he bought her another. She was staying in the camping ground, the beach side, not the river. Alone. Did it seem strange? She'd been coming here every Easter since she was 5. It felt like a second home. Glass empty, she decided she didn't need another. Shifted off the stool, a touch unsteady. They'll see each other around. He hopes so. She's in front of her tent playing lizard in the sun when he walks past 2 days later, fishing rod in hand. Like fish? Sure. We're having it for dinner. He doesn't wait for an answer. The change rooms haven't changed since the first time she was here. Walls made of mould, slippery piss-yellow tiles that snap-freeze your toes, throbbing pipes and taps that scald the skin off your fingers. But she doesn't mind. It's all part of the package. She shaves her legs with a blunt razor she found in the back of the car, just in case. It's a restless wait. Gravel crunches under boots. She looks up. Palms upturned, he shakes his head. There are at least 10 of them. They had bats, metal pipes. I managed to put in a bit of damage, but they took the whole catch. Rod too. That's funny. I didn't hear anything. They were quick. I see. Yeah, really got to watch the gangs around here. Pretty dangerous place. In the last of the light, she looks around. There's a family with a caravan over near the wall of old gums that border the edge of the park. A little girl rides past on a bright pink bike, expression serious, helmet slung low across her brow. Typical gangster. Like fish and chips? She can't help it, he's laughing too. They take it over to the wharf, sit with legs slung over the side. It's wrapped in newspaper, like it should be. This is actually just something I prepared earlier. Mmm, delicious. He flashes an oil-smeared smile. The chat is easy. He doesn't ask too much about her, picking up quick on her reluctance. So he talks about himself with a self-deprecating wit that makes her laugh. Music teacher, few years out from Lismore Uni, moved from one edge of the state to the other. She offers a bit about her own work. It's easy to talk about that. He's never met a children's book illustrator before. He kisses her goodbye in the corner of lips and cheek. She could have turned her head. She rubs her legs together soft and smooth beneath the sheets and imagines his belly pressed against hers. She should have turned her head. She's up early the next day for a ride to Bastion Point. It's been a while since the last time she was here, and she'd forgotten about a few of the hills on the road out. She can already feel it in her thighs, that good burn that reminds you about muscles that have lain dormant for too long. She stays out there a while, watching the surfers catch clean 3 to 4 footers right onto the rocks. She hasn't surfed since Jeremy was around. She can imagine them out there, just bobbing like toys in a bathtub with nothing to say. That's what it felt like in the end, just bobbing along until it became harder and harder to keep her head above the surface. She doesn't feel like riding back yet, so she wanders over to the rocks, pausing here and there to admire the curly brown shell of a shark egg. The ride home's a breeze with the southerly hurling down the highway. There's a note tucked into the zipper of her tent. Barbecue tomorrow night. I'll swing by at 6 if you're keen. She's keen. She spends the rest of the day reading, punctuating chapters with cups of tea. She walks through the park to the wharf at dusk. The boats are lined up neatly along the shore. There aren't many. The park is quiet at this time, just young families and retirees outside the bindings of the school term. She mulls over Max. It's been so long since she's met someone this easy to get along with. Lately, after the split, everything's been so busy. It's only now, away from it all, she realises the difference between being lonely and alone. She makes a detour via the IGA to grab dinner. Salad and sausages over the fire. The southerly stirred up some clouds and it gets dark quickly. She puts everything outside in the old wagon in case it rains and retreats to the warmth of her sleeping bag, even though it's only 8:30. Typical camper, rising and setting with the sun. She thinks about writing to him, to Jeremy, but there's only one thing she wants to say, that it was his fault too. The next day she's as jittery as a teenage girl. She can't focus on her book. She checks her phone. It's been off for the last few days. She calls her mum at lunch to let her know everything's fine. She doesn't feel like talking for long, so she makes up an excuse and keeps it short. It was her mum's idea to get away. She would have done it sooner. But if she's honest, she just wasn't ready. The thing with people is that they seep in, sometimes so deep that when they go, they leave so much of themselves inside, and the body needs time to push them out again, slowly, like a splinter. She heads down to the beach in the afternoon, swimmers on, even though it's going to be freezing. It always is here, especially in the inlet. It's low tide and she wades across to the surf. Her feet are numb by the time she's halfway across. She eventually makes it to the sea, and in nothing but her bikini runs at the shoreies with reckless abandon. It smacks the air out of her like a fist in the gut, but it's brilliant, breathless, euphoric. She's ready an hour and a half early, and spends the rest of the time between casual poses. When he finally arrives, he looks good, smells good too, and she's glad she packed something semi-respectable to wear. The barbecue's at his friend's house. Another teacher from school whose partner's just had a baby. Small group, very nice. The house is incredible, tucked away in a shady street close to the inlet. There's a tree trunk incorporated into one of the walls. It's such a warm, comfortable space. They're all out on the back deck. Max guides her through the hall, his hand just on the small of her back. Apart from the hosts, it's a bit of an older crowd. The women cluster around the wine and cheese, while the men look after the meat on the fire. Introductions are brief, a row of variously greying hair, sunspots and eyes on retirement. Max hands her a beer. The fire's too hot against her face and she has to take a step back. He's so close behind her that sometimes her shoulder brushes against his chest. She imagines his arm curling around her and resists the urge to lean back into him. Paul, the owner of the house, shares its easygoing feel. He's been teaching here for the last 5 years, grew up in Gippsland and met his wife at uni in Melbourne. There are black tyre tracks under his eyes. The baby is only 2 months old. Dinner is delicious, as good as the company, but by 9:30 seats shuffle back in an exodus of polite goodbyes. It's a school night after all. Can I walk you home? The cold air snaps her awake and draws the slow burn of wine from her cheeks. He takes her hand at the gate. She's halfway through a sentence about how incredible the house was and how much she liked everyone when he pulls her in for a kiss, slow, tinged with salt and wine. The unspoken agreement speeds them home. She smiles into his back, kisses the knuckles of his spine down until he rolls over again, taking her chin in his hand. The other slips between her thighs and the weight of him is almost more than she can bear. The sound of the tent zip wakes her. It must be early. It's still almost dark in the tent. A tight-lipped morning kiss, then he's gone. She falls back asleep until 9. The morning is slow. She cooks bacon and eggs on the little hot plate and stays in her PJs until noon. Sometimes she'll catch the smell of him on her skin and smile. He doesn't show up for 3 days. The first she spent working on some pictures for a book she brought with her. The second began to hurt. The third she spent contemplating packing up and heading home. Might have even packed and unpacked the car. Twice. He comes bearing gifts. A beautiful bottle of red they drink in the camp chairs in a pristine spring evening where the light stretches gold across the grass and everything seems unnaturally clear. It was his father, almost 70, had a turn, but he's right as rain now. Makes you think, though, gave everyone a bit of a scare. Can I cook you dinner? At his house this time, and she likes the boldness. The drive out is surprisingly far. They're pretty silent in the car. She's too shy to watch him, but she can feel his eyes on her. Instead, she watches his hands, big on the wheel, calloused and roughed from the guitar. She likes this man and wants to give him something. The silence baits her. He's waiting and the shame heats her cheeks in the dark. She winds down the window and lets the night air thrum between them. The last thing she wants is pity. I left my fiancé at the altar. He raises his eyebrows like he's not sure if it's a joke, and suddenly the gravity of it all seems to diminish, the melodrama gone. He's not one of her friends, or Jeremy's friends. He's on no one's side. It's time she stopped dividing the people in her life into sides. It was about 6 months ago. He lets it stew for a while, his eyes back on the road. Takes guts. He scratches at his stubble, the roughness of hair beneath nails. He's not angry, upset, kicking her out of the car. Yeah, she laughs, not sure why it seems funny. Things have been a bit intense. She chews a lip in explanation. I can imagine. I just felt like, I don't know, like we were characters in a play or something. Just acting it out, not really feeling things anymore. She shrugs, embarrassed. Sounds silly, I know. Sounds like you did the right thing. Then it's done, all wrapped up and put away. She feels so light she could float out the window and into the night, where beady eyes flash red in the sulphur glow of the high beam. He's very serious when he cooks, forehead creased over a recipe book. I thought you'd be more of a chuck-in-whatever kind of guy. She steals a slice of capsicum from the chopping board. I've many secrets, he jokes. She blushes, thinking of her own recently divulged, but there's no malice in his voice, only jest. She leaves him to it and wanders through the place. It's a converted shearer's quarters out the back of an old farmhouse. She can see lights on in the windows, and it feels nice to know there's someone else not too far away. It must get lonely out here. Beautiful, but lonely. After dinner, they sink into armchairs of a different era. It's so cozy in front of the fire, and a little bit drunk, she nuzzles into him. His arm reaches over her shoulders. They're quiet for a bit, but it's a different kind of silence, soft and warm. She rides the shallow waves of his chest until their breathing becomes rhythmic. She imagines them as one of her drawings, joined forever by lines on a page, and tries not to move. It'd be nice, he says to the top of her hair. What? It'd be nice if you stayed for a while. She lets herself imagine the elasticity of his skin sagging with age. The ladders beside his eyes seem so profound, and she thinks how it'd be nice to have some of her own.
That was Elisa Parry reading her story Illustrations. You can find that in the Space issue of VoiceWorks magazine. And that's all from us tonight. Join us next Monday. Genevieve will be back from New York City, and we'll be talking about islands, islands of another kind, very specifically, islands in the Indian Ocean. We're talking to Robert Drew about his memoir Montebello and John Doust about colonial island life in the 1960s. That's Monday from 7. Until next week.